this is going to be a great and wonderful show. And if you were listening a month ago, you have sort of a peripheral understanding when our guest was Professor Art Evans. And Art is an editor with Wesleyan University Press. And people are going to start thinking that I have got to be a shill for Wesleyan University Press, or that I'm being paid by them, because I have got to tell you that these folks don't, at least in their science fiction series, don't put out a bad book. About, oh, I'd say 6 months ago, I got a book by Albert Robida. Albert, by the way, is my middle name, so for me it's Albert, okay? But properly speaking en français, it would be Albert Robida. And Monsieur Robida, wrote a novel called, translated into English, The 20th Century. Those who are longtime listeners to this program and have listened to a frequent guest who's also the subject of a Wesleyan University Press book that just came out, Samuel R. Delaney. When Delaney comes on this program and likes to talk about the history of science fiction, a lot of people like to talk about Mary Shelley. Some people like to go back to Aristophanes. Delaney refers to the scientific romances of the 19th century that came out of France. And that is what this book is. And the gentleman who put together this project, translated the book, and wrote the introduction is basically bringing the 19th century book, the 20th century, into the 21st century. No, I didn't rehearse that. I just thought it up. Aren't I proud of myself? Is our guest this morning, Philippe Williams. And so I'll start by saying good morning.
Good morning.
Ah, there we are. I found your mic level that quickly. And my first question is, I know that you are a professor, but I wasn't sure about the proper – I know with Art Evans, it's like Dr. Evans. Would it be Professor Williams would be the formal –
Yes.
Okay. So and where are you, Professor? What are your
I'm at Northern Illinois University.
Okay.
In the Department of Foreign Languages and Literatures.
Okay, I'm sorry. Say that again, because I did lose your mic for a moment.
I work in the Department of Foreign Languages and Literatures at Northern Illinois University.
Northern, which is what city?
Near Chicago. It's in DeKalb, Illinois.
Tell us, what does that actually mean? What do you encompass? What kind of a syllabus would one expect from a course?
Oh, it depends. I teach a variety of courses. I teach language courses. I teach culture courses, translation, literature courses.
When you say translation, in other words, how to translate?
Yes, techniques of translation.
Ooh, okay.
Strategies about how to render ideas from one culture to the other.
Yeah. It's a topic that is dear to some of the guests on this program. And in fact, last year, on this program, I had a theme. Not every show, but whenever I could, I was trying to present science fiction or fantasy that did not originate in English.
Right.
And the biggest problem that I have is that so little has been translated. And much which has been translated was done poorly. So frequently people just don't know that all these wonderful books, all these wonderful science fiction novels in Russian and all that. And these are generally not the ones that get made into the big movies.
I think the problem is that, from my understanding, translation is not a domain in which you will get rich. So I think only people with a passion translates novels that will not turn into huge sellers.
Yeah. And yet I would think that, given that science fiction has a very definite market here, I would think that publishers would be very happy to deal with already published things that have made their mark in other countries.
I suppose so, yes.
You would think. And you would think that there would be more editors. And there are a handful of editors who do. Michael Kandel specializes a lot in Polish and Russian science fiction and things like that. But this stuff just doesn't make it to our show. To our shore. I should point out, by the way, that one of everybody is familiar with the writer Philip K. Dick, and there have been all these really basically awful movies and or bad translations, if you will, of Dick from the novel to the screen. The best translation ever of a Philip K. Dick novel to the screen is a French film called Barjo. Have you ever heard of this movie?
No, I'm very surprised to hear this.
It's I mean, this is an obscure movie in France, much less here. It's not available on DVD, and it's probably out of print in VHS, but it does exist. It's Barjo, and it's
which means crazy in slang.
Exactly, and the novel is Confessions of a Crap Artist.
Oh yeah,
which is one of Dick's fun, semi-mainstream. It's not hard science fiction, but it is peculiar and fun.
And I have to say, I started reading Philip K. Dick when I was a kid, and until they started making movies with his from his books in the late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah,
I would say Dick was better known in France or in Europe, maybe in general, than he was in the United States.
Yeah, that's probably true. As far as the mainstream audience is concerned, I mean, within the world of science fiction, he was highly regarded.
Yeah, sure.
But in terms of going into the local bookstore, was another thing altogether.
Yeah.
What brought you to science fiction and fantasy? Was it reading as a child?
You mean in my private life or this project?
In your private life, to begin with.
I learned how to read by myself reading comics before I went to school. And so I guess I read a lot as a child. I reread a lot, and I had a vivid imagination, and I loved those stories that stimulated my imagination.
What were the early books you were reading?
The earliest science fiction books I read were the American science fiction books from the 40s, 50s, and 60s. Van Vogt was, I don't remember what it's called in English, because of course I read those in translation, but I think Null A. The World of Null A must have been my first science fiction book when I was maybe 10 or 11 years old.
One of my first.
And
as
I moved
well.
To Asimov and Dick, of course, and Delaney, and some, all those American writers.
Uh-huh. And just reading that sort of brought you to it. What led you to know about, let's say Robida?
Robida, I came across Robida quite accidentally. My parents love antiques and flea markets and libraries. And one day, my mother found a book that contained a selection of Robida images. Because we have to see that this novel here is an illustrated novel. And
gorgeously illustrated,
right.
I should say. One of the joys of the book are all these line drawings throughout.
Right,
very,
and
very
so
ornate.
Robida has been forgotten by the general public since the 1920s, 30s. But there was a book made of that collected many of his images of the future that showed vehicles of the future, streets of the future, societies of the future, behavior, war in the future. And so once my mom found one of those books, which is now out of print, and said, look at this. You like science fiction, and look at this. This is quaint science fiction from the 19th century, and it looks like comics. And I agreed. I thought it was great. And so I enjoyed the book, and I put it aside. And then when time came for me to, as a grad student, to write a dissertation, and I was trying to find a subject that I would like to live with, I suddenly remembered Robida, and I decided to check out what the text, because I knew that there was a text that originally accompanied these images. And that's when I started doing research on Robida and a new world opened up for me.
So tell us a little bit about him. Who was he?
Albert Robida was born in the middle of the 19th century in 1848 in a very traditional bourgeois, middle-class family. He was a young boy that was affected with severe, how do you say in English, myopia? Can you say myopia?
Yes.
He was very nearsighted.
Myopia
and
is exactly
he had a vivid imagination. And very early on, he had a passion for history. He lived in a region. He was born in Compiègne, which is northeast of Paris, in the northern section of France, and it's a region with many historical ruins. And this child, as a child, he had a passion for drawing. Unfortunately, his nearsightedness his career was almost nipped in the bud. When he went to school and the art teacher refused to teach him art because he was so nearsighted. So Albert Robida learned. He was not discouraged, but he decided to practice drawing by himself at home. And I personally think that his nearsightedness somewhat isolated him from his environment, but developed his imagination. So when he became an adult, he was a very shy, introvert character with a vivid imagination.
Mm-hmm.
He moved to Paris when he was 19. At the time, there was a very lively magazine market in Paris. This was a time when the magazine market was booming, and he found himself surrounded by publications that were looking for cartoonists, political cartoonists, satirical cartoonists. And so at the age of 19, Robida started providing cartoons for a variety of magazines. Very quickly, he earned a reputation for his humor and for his depiction of future wars that was quite imaginative and original at the time. And very soon he found himself the director of one of these magazines. And he turned out to be one of the, I would say, a major figure in the turn of the century popular culture. He was everywhere. Once he was established, he was everywhere. So he directed the magazine. He provided cartoons for a myriad of other magazines. He wrote novels. He illustrated classics, Shakespeare, Cervantes, French classics. He also created a display at the 1900 Universal Exposition.
Uh-huh.
He recreated the old Paris. He recreated a section of Paris made up of streets from the Middle Ages, the 15th century, 16th century, 17th century, 18th century, with extras, and. So my point is that he was all over the place.
Yeah.
And everybody knew him at the end of the 19th century. And when the 20th century started and his inventions about the future became more and more commonplace, I mean, vehicles, telephones, flying vehicles, all this became less and less science fiction-like and more true.
Mm-hmm.
little by little, he became more and more obsolete, and he died in 1926, and he was virtually forgotten, save for a few enthusiasts.
But why would that be? I mean, people remember Verne, but not Robida.
And I would say Verne is a major, Verne's fame is a major factor in the fact that Robida has been forgotten, because while they were both alive, they occupied very distinct territories in both literature and pop culture. excuse me, Verne, Jules Verne at the time was the biggest seller of books in the world, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And so he completely overshadowed. Well, Robida was alive. Excuse me, he was well known, but after he died, when he started being only a memory, I guess people started saying, oh, wasn't he the guy who wrote novels a little like Jules Verne?
Uh-huh.
And that little by little, he became overshadowed, eclipsed by Jules Verne's fame.
Yeah, yeah. And so it's just one of those issues of not quite marketing, but how people remember other things. And it's something that happens often, and it's so sad. It's like all the great court composers who had to share the court with Mozart. They're simply, you know, for example, Salieri, who's only remembered today because of that play called Amadeus, is why many Americans know the name Salieri. Otherwise, they wouldn't know. Salieri is a wonderful composer.
And what's very ironic in this case also is that, so not only Rubida was remembered as some kind of a Verne clone, mistakenly, but Jules Verne himself has been remembered mainly for his science fiction when he, and actually my colleague Arthur Evans probably mentioned this, Jules Verne wrote very few true science fiction stories,
right.
Narratives.
Yeah.
And so it's amazing. It tells volumes, it speaks volumes about the control that an author has on his work once it's given to the public.
Which has sadly not changed today. how much science fiction? Now, what was the term? What would Verne and Rubida have called their work at that time?
Jules Verne's novels were called scientific novels.
Are they okay?
H.G. Wells were scientific romances.
Right.
But Jules Verne in French, it was roman scientifique. And Rubida himself did not. I'm not aware that he gave such a label to his writings because. The thing is, his science fiction novels have a very strong societal dimension. He's very interested in behaviors. So, of course, hardware plays a great role in his stories, and they are well represented in the drawings that accompany the text. But his focus, I would say, was more on the behavior that the machines of the future would create with the people. So, in that sense, his writing was as much anchored into the bourgeois drama of the time, the theater, the satirical stories about high society life, and it was not only focused on science fiction.
That's something that struck me very much was how social, really, his work is. Verne was more, in my way of thinking, more intent on a particular political statement or scientific statement. There is frequently just the sense of let's have an adventure.
And actually, I would say he carefully avoided any political statements.
Yeah. A lot of people impose their own political statements onto the framework that Verne provided, especially with, you know, say using the Captain Nemo character or some such. But Rubida, it's just delightful, wonderful stuff. And the hindsight of reading this book, taking a look at what year are we? Is the 20th century set in
1880? It's supposed to take place in 1952, 1953.
But it's written in the 80s.
1882.
Yeah. But why don't you describe the book a little for us?
So let's see. The book is first. I have to say that talking about it on the radio doesn't give justice to the book because of the amount of illustrations.
Yeah, this is very true.
So this is a highly unusual book in that it's a hybrid narrative that's constituted as much of words as of images.
Mm-hmm.
So the novel is heavily illustrated by Albert Rubida himself, and it contains more than 300 images. And what's highly unusual, so as you said,
how long did it take him to write this? Must have been.
I'm not sure. We don't have, you know, there are very few.
He didn't just dash it off, I don't think. This is a labor of love.
Well, what happened is this: he started by the images.
Uh-huh.
When he moved to Paris to start making cartoons, one day he thought of writing a cartoon on the war of the future. And this had a lot of success, and he wrote more and more cartoons about what the hardware of future warfare would be.
Uh-huh.
And so this was a project that took...
That's funny because that's still a common theme in science fiction today, right. The hardware of future warfare.
Right, but so little by little, he became more and more involved in describing the future.
Uh-huh.
And so I don't know exactly how long it took him to write this novel, but the novel is... what's fascinating about this novel is that it depicts the life of the people 70 years ahead of his time.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a very uncommon interplay between the words and the images. And very often, an illustration, illustrates a strong moment in the narrative. For instance, if you take the classic example of Jules Verne's novels, an illustration depicts the hero in danger.
Yeah.
For instance, a very strong moment. Whereas in Robida, the images function a little bit like footnotes in that they don't, more often than not, they don't duplicate information that's in the written text. So for instance, you will have a scene, let's say you have a scene with two people having a conversation with one another, like we are having here,
mm-hmm.
and the image on the next page will show the types of costumes that these people of the future will wear, so as not to overload the written text with those secondary details. And this is one of the great original dimensions of Albert Robida's novel. There are much more than this, but on the formal level, I would say this is the most immediately noticeable difference with all the other novels of his time, but especially all the other science fiction novels of his time.
Mm-hmm. What are his topics? What is he writing about?
He's writing about the everyday behavior associated with what the hardware of the future will bring. For instance, he predicted the internet pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
He has this invention called the telephonoscope, which what's fascinating about this is that until the end of the 20th century, his telephonoscope, to any reader who came across his book, must have come across as a very naive apparatus that was just too convenient to be true. I mean, you can communicate verbally with people on the other side of the planet. You can watch theater plays in the comfort of your own home.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like a video phone, telephone. You can do, there's a home shopping network associated to it. And so what was apparently naive fantasy throughout the whole 20th century is now a reality today. And so Albert Robida...
Or even then, I would say, not quite a reality today. The companies doing this stuff are still struggling to put it together.
Mm-hmm.
They really have not... They have the concepts there. They have some of the tools. But as far as I'm concerned, and I write about this stuff, they haven't pulled it all together yet.
All right. And so what Robida writes about is how people deal with those, with what progress had brought them. Remember that the 19th century, I mean, at the time Robida writes, it's in the midst of the positivistic period when many people in society are dreaming about what scientific progress is going to bring to humankind and the happiness that's going to come from that. So what Robida talks about is behaviors associated with hardware of the future. He talks a lot about female emancipation, women's emancipation, which was a hot topic of his time as well. He likes to talk about war, although he doesn't talk too much about it in this book, but he has other novels in which he talks a lot about war of the future. And basically, he just likes to show what the daily life of people of the future will be.
Yeah, and that was, for me, much of the joy of the book was the mundane activity as opposed to the particular events and the social depictions. In his way, I think today we would probably refer to his book as being somewhat feminist. Would that be a fair...
This is a complex issue because earlier we mentioned that Rovira did not really make political statements, and his attitude towards women in society reflects an ambiguity that you can find in all his work. Uh-huh. So, for instance, if you look at the images, this book seems to be a very feminist book of the 19th century. And actually, one of the reprints of this 20th century novel was subtitled The Story of a Young Woman of the Future, of a Parisian Young Woman of the Future.
Uh-huh.
And so in the story, he has women occupy functions in society that they could not occupy in 19th century France. Women are lawyers, doctors, politicians, journalists, writers, and that was very uncommon. We did have some female writers, but they were a minority.
Mm-hmm.
So apparently, Rovira pushes the independence of women in a way that was not common at all in the 19th century. However, his main character turns out to be a woman who does not take advantage of all the
opportunities.
Of all the opportunities, thank you, that this enlightened society has to offer.
Mm-hmm.
And Rovira, whenever political subjects come up, Rovira is interesting in that he has many, many liberal tendencies and many conservative reflexes. So he tries constantly to push ideas that were considered very liberal for his time, but then when you look closer, he has these reflexes that make his society, after all, fall back into very traditional postures.
Mm-hmm.
I would say he's a bourgeois with a conscience. he talked about so many themes that are still very important today. For instance, he predicted pollution, and he was very much against it, of course. He talked about war a lot, but he was a very active pacifist. He talked about chemical warfare, bacteriological warfare, and When he describes political struggles in his novels, or also in his he did some writing that was not novels. He happened to be in Paris in 1870 when Paris was besieged by the Prussians. The Germans at the time were called the Prussians. So there was a siege of Paris and an ensuing short-lived insurrection known as the Commune, which was some kind of a civil war in Paris. And Rovira was stuck in Paris at the time, and he kept a journal of this, which is an incredible historical document. And I think, from what I know, a new version of it is going to be published very soon in France. But throughout his writing, you can see that he has no empathy for insurrections, for political movements that disturb the established order.
Mm.
However, he has much, much sympathy for the individual who fights for his or her own rights. So he's
very interesting.
All of his writing is pulled between these two tendencies. Whether you talk about women's rights, or political struggles, he seems to favor the individual, but have a negative outlook onto any movement that will disturb the established order, the status quo.
Yeah, and he's not writing about the government too much. We really don't get...
In a very fancy way, in this novel, he talks about this decennial revolution, whereby every 10 years, the French people... It's a satire, of course, but every 10 years, the French people have a revolution to topple the current government and replace it with another one.
Yeah, but this was an idea that Thomas Jefferson promoted here. Jefferson said whenever a revolutionary organization became the status quo, it should be torn down.
But actually, this is a very bloodless revolution. This is completely staged.
Uh-huh.
And actually, I'll be happy to read part of the novel that details with it later if you want.
Fine, absolutely. And in fact, we're approaching that time of morning where I like to get the reading started. Would you like to take a break first?
Sure.
Okay.